I've heard most of you been here in Ithaca for a long time, and I came here like 8-9 years ago, and besides these kind of events and stuff, you know, I'm still feel like I'm in the 60s.
Yeah.
When I hear a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of beautiful people here, and there's a lot of people here who work real hard for change and stuff. But in the 9 years that I've been here, I still go to the Commons, and the stores on the Commons still don't have any black people working in them. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for me, it's just like, you know, is this really, I mean, it just says to me, you know, how much work can you do, really? And so I also today was the first time that I've heard somebody speak of how Martin Luther King views were kind of like changing. He wasn't becoming violent, but he was understanding that movement also. And I was real impressed this morning by the speaker. But I also wanted to hear either the panel or people in the audience of your feelings on the act. Okay, September 11th act was so, so painful for everyone. But is it any more painful than what the terrorism that happens in this society every day? And I think it's kind of like what he was saying. I could so identify with it, how this, that thing has really deterred us. I mean, I'm real proud to be an American, but I'm an African American first, and it still pains me to see that the jails are still overcrowded with African Americans and Latinos. And that, you know, are we really educating one another? Are we really educating each other? Are we really doing the work that we need to do? And, you know, so my question is, who else agrees with this being that there are acts of terrorism going on in this country every day? Not with airplanes, but denying people the privileges that some have. And it would be real unrealistic to sit in here and say that, you know, having white skin, no matter what your culture is not an up in this state, in this country. And just how other people view do that, because that matters to me a lot, you know. And I guess I'm a real loving person too, so I was watching a show last night, you know, Feed the Hungry, and watching kids in Africa still with their stomachs bloated, you know, the highest number of AIDS cases. Do people think of those things besides me? Because sometimes I think I'm just too sensitive, but I don't know. Those are just some of the views. And these are the days that we gather together, and these are the days that we get together and we love each other. And tomorrow, does this happen? Do you challenge your jobs when you leave here and say, why we only got one person of color working here? You know, do you do these things on a daily basis? Do you look around your employment and say, much has not changed, you know? I'm going to put them on the spot, but it's a few treatment programs in this area. You can count the people of color who works for them. And so I'm saying to say that, do we still challenge people after Martin Luther King Day? Do we go in the Commons and say, why you have no people of color working in your establishment? Do we ask why we don't have any soul food restaurants? You know, and that's important. I left a one of these conferences one time, and I wanted to do something, and it didn't work out, but I felt like after the day, what do we do? Do we get groups together? Do we start visiting each other? You know, do I invite you to my house and do you invite me to your house? Do you ask me the questions that you've never asked? Like, why is your hair so creaky? You know, when you perm your hair, it gets curly. When I perm my hair, it gets straight. Those are the things that I say, do we do that on a daily basis? And we don't. I don't, you know? And I'm not putting other people on the spot. I'm just food for thought. Like, what do we do after this day is over? You know, do I stay up on the campus or do I get down here in this area? Because this is not a ghetto. I'm from Harlem. this is beautiful. But anyway, that's just my comments. But I still am real grateful to hear of the things that you do.
When I came out of the meeting downstairs, you probably got one of these given to you like I did. Living wages build community, and Martin Luther King, that's what he was stressing, that economic thing, right up to the moment he died. Well, that kind of coalition is building in this community, and that's going to help speak to the things you're experiencing. It's fundamental, it's basic. And so we have to join such coalitions and put our own presence, I don't know how to say it, in support of it. That's one of it, anyway.
I want to appreciate you for raising that issue, because I think it is central. And I think making the connections from the political to the personal is really important, that as a white person, it's not in my face every day unless I have people of color that I care about. And then it's in my face because I have connections and I see that pain. It's right there in front of me. And so I have to have that. So we do have to reach for each other afterwards. We do have to have those connections. And, you know, I appreciate you raising it. I don't have it together. But I also think that the racism in the society is profound. And the racism against African-American people in particular is different because you were brought here as slaves. I mean, your ancestors were brought here as slaves, and we as a society have not ever really acknowledged how important that is and how profound that difference is. You know, it must be, you know, it's sort of maddening that there's racism against Asians big time, but they come here and they make it, you know? And black people who have been here for hundreds of years still aren't making it in that way. So there is a difference there, and I think it is the responsibility of white people individually and collectively to do something to end that racism. I mean, black people obviously are driven to do that, and it's important to do that, but I think it's the responsibility of white people individually and collectively to do that. I think it can be done, but it's profound. It's not, you know, and there's all those little steps are important. Getting those jobs, getting that living wage and so on are important, but there's a profound healing that has to take place that's going to be a lot of work.
In the Catholic school, one time there was nothing but all white. Now, they want to get rid of these Catholic schools. You know why I think they're getting rid of them?
Why?
Because they got more blacks, maybe Hispanics. The way I figure, they only want too many black people that are smart. And they want to get rid of these schools now because they figure it's too many blacks now that's getting educated. So they're going to get rid of these black kids, and they're going to send them in some community, which is they're not educating the black people, kids too much. And they just list them off as, you know, a poor black. You know, they're not going to get that much education no more. Because you can, in the Catholic school, they can get a decent education to get where they want to get. But they find out that there's too many blacks that's getting educated.
That's the way I feel. Thank you for sharing that.
When I moved, I moved here from Harlem, and my attitude, I'm just talking reverse side. My attitude was, I don't really need to be around them. I got everything I need right in this community. I really don't want to get to know whites no more than they want to get to know me. And that was my attitude until I moved to Ithaca. And then, like for you, I can say that it's been an enlightening experience living in Ithaca, because now there's truly some white people that I love, you know, that I consider as my sister. And that's why I say the only way that things will change is education. And I'm not talking about education at the elite colleges. I'm talking about education of getting to know other people that are different from you. And it don't happen in this one day. It happens by doing something after this to connect with other people.
What I have a problem with, and I'm always yakking about, we don't talk to our children about our culture, about slavery. And I think they need to know what our ancestors went through. I've told my children about us being I was brought up in Georgia, and I walked. I had to go before a judge before I could vote. And I had 3 years of college, but I had to go before a judge. So we need to talk to our children about what slavery meant, how strong our forebears were, and how strong they are, and what they can do. And not let them be browbeaten just because we are black. We need to let them know what's what. And we need to talk to each other. The young people need to look, don't look at me as some old woman. Look at me as somebody who can maybe tell you a little bit of something. We have four successful children. And we talked to them, and I stayed home. I didn't get out because I worked. I had to work. But I did not leave them at home. I went to the schools and made sure the schools knew I was their parent. And so I think if we talk to our young people and let our people know that drugs is just another form of slavery. Mm-hmm. You can get out there on those drugs all you want to, but you a slave. So don't talk to me about, I don't want to hear about slavery. You already a slave if you're doing drugs. Mm-hmm. Let our children know that.
This is Mrs. Jackie Mountain Scott. She has been down in the gym with a number of other community leaders and activists working out a plan for what are we going to do to impact in a dramatic and positive way the miseducation that our children are receiving within the Ithaca City School District. So I'm glad that she could come for a few minutes, and maybe, Jackie, if you would like to talk about
Let me just say that my passion, and I'm really, really excited to see as many people as we have here, and some of my fellow senior citizens now. I am legally a senior citizen as of January 1st this year. What? Yeah, join the group. Thank you. Thank you. One of my passions has been education. And I guess since I was 12, I've been involved in education. I was one of those people that you didn't have to ask me. I was always there. I was out on the front lines even at 12, advocating for equity. I remember as a young person even saying, making a statement recognizing the oppressive position that Cornell University has put this city in at 12. I've called them the slave master. And the counter to that, if people understand what the economics of slavery has been, if you modernize it, looking at Cornell University and the city, for example, how many of you know that the tower, Cornell Tower, is on the Ithaca telephone book? I bet nobody paid any attention. All right. I was outraged. I was absolutely outraged that was allowed to happen. Now, why did it happen? Because obviously Verizon has some investment in Cornell University, or someone at Cornell University has some investment in Verizon. So I said, now, those are the kind of things that we need to pay attention to. I bring those things to bear with young people as well as older people as much as possible, and I do it on a one-to-one basis. I don't wait to be asked. I see something that's going on, then I address it. Have been called sassy, articulate since I was 12 years old. Now, because education is a passion of mine, I see a lot. I see a lot and participate. I teach teachers to be observant. I teach teachers to be global thinkers. I teach teachers to honor all students. I teach teachers to look at who we are today. When I was a youngster in school, in this room was my kindergarten room with Miss McCracken. Some of you have heard this. And I remember this room like I was sitting in here in this area in the music, because it was Froebel's approach, where there were the different sections, the language and the playhouse and the music. I was in the music. And I was playing the drums. And the kindergarten teacher, Miss McCracken, when we were gathered together, said, okay, we're having an open house. Who's going to play the triangles? And some kids raised their hand. Who's going to play this? Who's going to play the drum? I raised my hand. Miss McCracken said, but you're a little girl. You can't play the drums. And I said,
But if I don't play the drums, there's not going to be a band because I'm the only one that can keep the rhythm.
And sat down. Now, Miss McCracken looked at me and said, "You know, you're right." Now, I used that as an example with teachers to say that she could have flipped my whole attitude around by saying to me, "No, you can't." I could have contributed to that if I hadn't come from the strong base that I came from. Like Mrs. Graham was saying, is I had confidence and license to speak out because it came from my parents, because I was clear who I was. Now, we have to teach children. I don't care who the children are. Economically, we are basically equal. This country has made us different by race. Our common denominator is what we have in the bank. And that's one of the reasons why Martin Luther King was such a threat to the establishment. Because when he talked about coming together on the war on poverty, that would pull people together from all races. Because it is about economics. Now, economics is also influencing, are you aware of this, the way our children are taught? Because it is always assumed, because a person is from a low economic background, they cannot learn as well as the next child. And that the teachers are from the higher economic strata, so they have already discarded those children who are below their strata. It is done unconsciously because teachers are still being taught with the same paradigm that we were taught. In the colleges, they're still being taught the same way, even though there's this little course that talks about diversity. And my slogan is, when someone says we got to talk about diversity, I open up and it says, "Diversity is." That's all I need to say. It isn't a question. There's no discussion. Diversity is. What we need to do is address it as a given. That's what that means. It's nothing new. It is an evolution of who we are as a people in this United States of America, the land of the free. And we are diverse by virtue of that proclamation. So it isn't anything new. We need to recognize the changes and to work towards that. I am a natural activist. I've decided I don't need anybody to lead me, you know. I don't need to be following anybody. If something needs to be done, I will do it. And hopefully other people will be able to see that it's important to join in that process. We are going through crisis in our educational system in Ithaca, New York. It has been going on. And I've been saying this since God knows when. You do not go to the oppressor and ask for freedom. You have got to decide for yourself what you want. You set the path to accomplish that, and you tell the oppressor, "This is what we're doing." And if we don't start doing that, I already am recognizing in our school system, and this is sad, and I deal with it every day. We are recognizing, at least I am, and I'm bringing it to bear among the people that I associate with, that the children that we are reaching right now who are entering our school are at least third generation of poverty. Now, what does that mean? That means that their parents have been miseducated, their grandparents have been miseducated, and probably their great-great-grandparents. And why? Because they've come through an economic system in Ithaca, New York, who has kept them in poverty. So they enter into the school system in the class of poverty. And they're treated as throwaways. Now that's deep. But yet, our school system keeps spending money to send administrators and teachers to workshops on diversity and institutional racism. And guess what? That costs money. We have a whole, there's a sister there, here's one here. We could teach the class on institutional racism, and it wouldn't cost them as much as they're paying to get people to come from Washington, from Philadelphia. But it isn't about always presenting those workshops. It's about taking action to use the material that is not new material on how we do it. But there's too much blindness, too much blindness. But let me tell you, until I can't speak, till I can't walk, till my eyes are shut for forever tight, I am still going to be out there letting folks know that it is not enough for you to complain. You've got to take some action.
And I just wanted to tie it all up. I mean, this is beautiful. I mean, when it said elder, I thought of me. I don't know. And I'm 47. So, and I think I'm young too.
That's
you
right.
know, I'm confused. But I'm also a recovering addict. And I was hearing what you said. And I was hearing what Ms. Graham said. And those things don't always stop people from going to drugs. Your mother being home or whatever, you know. But what Ms. Scott said is important also, that, you know, our kids are in school more time than they're with us. So that's another part of education, drug education. And I'm not talking about when they get in middle school. They start to get high by then. I'm talking about educating them from kindergarten about it in the schools, you know. And I agree with the, our monies are just being thrown away sometimes because some of the things that we have our resources right in this room to have to go outside of it and pay if we just look close. And I'm glad this was real good for me. You know, thanks.
Ms. Scott and then this gentleman over here.
I think, again, I'd like to repeat that this dialogue, you know, like what motivates people to do what they do. I think that coming from a religious perspective, it has to do with greed and envy. And that if you look at the economic system that we're in, even though someone is in the higher income bracket, they spend less money on commodities than someone in the lower income bracket. Mm-hmm. And if we were to look at how we spend our money, where our priorities are, that many times the reasons that people look somewhere else for their strength is because they want something that they don't feel they can have. And that when they take some synthetic, then that tends to mask what is going on around them. You know, I've told kids before, and I'm not afraid to say it, you know, I've experimented, and I've told them that, you know, I've tried drugs that they can't even pronounce. And the difference in that is that I tried them, they didn't try me.
All right.
You know. And the whole point, when I talk to kids and I talk to people from all walks of life, I've been there. I haven't taken anything to the extreme that is going to hurt me, that will blur my vision towards what my overall life's vision is. And the thing is that we have to teach the children. It isn't about those $160 oh man, don't get me started in the industry. Let me tell you a little funny story. I've told these kids this many, many times in different sets in Boston and New York and Syracuse and here. Every Friday afternoon, there are five limousines, Corporate 500, that pick up a member of the Corporate 500 at their offices. Their office is bigger than your apartment. This is what I say to the kids. They get in this limousine and they've got, man, smoking TV, caviar, whatever they want in the limousine that's taking them to this office building. Now, the office building was probably at the Towers. And where they met in this room, this corporate room, was bigger than a mansion. They had waiters. They, again, had the choice of whatever they wanted to eat. Filet mignon, lobster, whatever. And the meeting starts at 5:15. They have choice of the top drawer bar. They can even snort a little Coke. They can do all of that in this meeting. The meeting starts at 5:15. Around that table are all men who are members of the Corporate 500. There's one woman. She's Asian.
and the chair of the board says, okay, what are we going to put on the street this week to get the niggas? And in 10 minutes, they've decided that. They now close the meeting, get in their car, in their limousines, go back to wherever they live. And this is on Friday. Saturday, the advertising campaign is out there. Sunday, it's on TV. Monday, the sales have been reported to be $100,000 at the climate. Now, what am I telling the kids? Most of these, obviously, are African-American kids. I'm telling them that they cannot talk about the oppressor without recognizing that they've been duped. They need to change it around. And I'm sharing this with you all because it is a mixed group, to understand what goes on in the minds of children and other adults. And we've got to start changing it. We've got to start changing it. And that's not a real story. The Family Opportunity Center at Beverly J. Martin School is a funded not-for-profit organization that actually was supposed to come through the school system, which I advised it not come through. So it's done privately through literacy volunteers. And what it's designed to do is to upgrade people's education who are at stop-gap positions, teach them how to take civil service examinations, prepare them for college, prepare them for job applications. And it's a literacy-based program. It is absolutely free. And you need to send young people over to that program. Young mothers, fathers can come to that program and be in this program while their children are in school. So you need to pass that along. And if you have job applications, I can find you people and can prepare them for. And you send those kind of applications over to me as family liaison, and I will coach folks who come for those applications to know what it's like to be a minority in some of those jobs, because there's a lot of pressure from folks who are in those jobs, already have those jobs, like in the janitors. The janitor jobs in the school system are mostly the supervisory jobs are held by Caucasians, European Americans who have had those jobs for long, their families have had them, etc., and they oppress anyone black who comes into that job because they don't want them to have them. There's a real block. These are stories that I get one-on-one. I don't ask for them. I get one-on-one for people who are in those positions. They are oppressed at the jobs to do things that the person that's ordering them to do will not do, and it's to provoke them into some reaction which may be violent or arrogant, and then they get fired. So it justifies them so that they can say, we tried, but nobody was qualified. And the barbershop is a good example. There was a big hullabaloo about the barbershop. Now, when I was a kid, there were 5 black barbershops in Ithaca. I can't even tell you how many hairdressers there were. There was a black tailor. There was a hotel on the corner of Corn and State Street that was Cuba House Hotel, and it housed the folks from Sampson Air Force Base who came into Ithaca, the city, from Sampson Air Force Base. There was Sam's Grill, had the best jazz jukebox in the entire upper New York state. There was the Skyline, which is out where the Common Ground is right now, owned by African Americans. There was a place up over where the ice cream place that just went out of business. What is it?
Ben and Jerry's.
It was called the Golfers Club, owned by African American. Now, I ask you, I left. I left here as soon as I could in 1954 to go to college. And when I came back, a lot of those things had begun to disappear. And the stories that I hear, which is a good example, the barbershop, was that they might get the license, but they would get harassed by the health department, by the building department, to close up because there has been racism in this city since I was a little girl and since my father, who was also born here, was a little boy. But you see, people don't talk about that because they want to think that things are better. Now, truly, they are a little better.
But you know what better means? Economic power. That's better.
That was Jackie Melton Scott, an Ithaca resident, speaking at the Elders Speak Out last month. An important update from the Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress on the continuing fight to prevent gas drilling in the forest. The Forest Service will be holding public meetings this month to allow the public to start working on the Land Resource Management Plan, which will determine the appropriate uses for the Finger Lakes National Forest for the next 15 years. As the future of the permanent congressional ban on drilling here doesn't look all that promising at the moment, it's very important that we do everything we can to influence the Land Resource Management Plan. This is a chance to actually take part in the formation of policies that govern the use of the Finger Lakes National Forest, rather than just commenting on a plan that has already been drawn up by the Forest Service. There will be two meetings this month. The Finger Lakes Forest Watch Congress is asking people concerned about the forest to try to make one of them in order to put the drilling to rest for good. Here are the meeting times and places. Monday, February 11th, 7 p.m. at the Lodi Fire Hall. Wednesday, February 13th, 7 p.m. at Watkins Glen High School. That's repeat. Monday, February 11th, 7 p.m. at the Lodi Fire Hall. Wednesday, February 13th, 7 p.m. at Watkins Glen High School. The two meetings will be essentially the same, so it's only necessary to attend one of them. For more info, contact Steve Wagner at stevetrails@hotmail.com. That's STEVETRAILS, stevetrails@hotmail.com. We'll conclude our program tonight with a talk by sociologist and author Robert Bullard on the links between environmental justice, racism, and the legacy of the civil rights movement.
I'm a sociologist by training. I'm an environmental sociologist. And I'm proud to say that I am an environmentalist. And I've been black most of my life. If we talk about the environment, I think it's very important to understand that the environment is everything. And when we talk about environmental justice, the issues that I will be talking with you briefly this afternoon are issues that I've been working on for the last 20 years, and I was inspired 20 years ago, and I'm still inspired by this brave hero, Dr. King. Environmental justice for all, keeping King's legacy alive. If we define the environment, what is it? The environment is everything. It's where we live, work, play, go to school, as well as the physical and natural world. We're all environmentalists. I gave two talks this morning in class, and I asked students who were environmentalists, and that was mixed feelings. And when I went through the scenario of, if you breathe the air, if you drink the water, if you are concerned about what's in your food, if you drive a car, most of us are concerned about what happens as a result of the things that we do, our activities. So we're all environmentalists. Some of us may be still in the closet and don't know it. When we talk about this question of environmental justice means equal enforcement of environmental laws, identifying and eliminating discriminatory practices and policies, whether these practices and policies have direct impact, that are intended or unintended, it doesn't matter. When we talk about addressing disproportionate and disparate and adverse impacts that result in environmental contamination or human health impacts, we're talking about real issues. These are not issues that were somehow invented by some radical sociologists. These are real. And the most important part of environmental justice is basically getting people at the table who need to be at the table. So I'm very pleased to be in Vermont. I'm very pleased to speak to individuals and people and organization leaders and just everyday people about the environment and what we all can do. We all have a part to play. We're all part of the problem, but we can also be part of the solution. So environmental justice also means involving people and getting the most impacted at the table to speak for themselves. You know, Malcolm said, just because you sit at the table doesn't make you a diner. You have to be eating from the table to be a diner. The environmental justice movement is about creating diners. It's about creating people who have information, who can make informed decisions about their lives and the lives of their children and their community. So when we talk about this whole question of the principle of environmental justice embraces the principle that all communities have a right to equal protection of our environmental laws, our housing laws, our health laws, our transportation laws, and our civil rights laws. All these things are intertwined. When we talk about the right to breathe clean air, is that in the Constitution? Probably not. But it is a basic right. No corporation has a right to poison communities. No corporation. That is not in the Constitution. So when we talk about basic rights and we talk about privileges, just because a community happens to be poor, happens to be located on the wrong side of the track spatially, and just because it happens to be working class or a community of color, does not mean that it deserves less protection or unequal enforcement. So when we talk about this whole question, how does Dr. King's legacy relate to environmental justice? We have to understand that in 1968, Dr. King went to Memphis, Tennessee, on an environmental justice mission, striking garbage workers. If you don't think garbage is an environmental issue, let the garbage workers go on strike. They have to call out the National Guard. And they did. Dr. King did not make it out of Memphis in 1968 alive. Houston, Texas, 1978, 10 years later, involving garbage, landfills, and this whole issue of siting a facility in the middle of an African-American suburban neighborhood, predominantly black, Northwood Manor. This is not a poor community. This is not a ghetto. This is a solid, middle-class, predominantly black community. Now, when I say predominantly black, that's like me saying my family is predominantly black. This is an all-black suburban community. How do we know? Jim Crow did it. This company, and I'm not going to call any names, but the initials are BFI, wanted to put this landfill in the middle of this neighborhood, and they had the audacity to call the landfill, sanitary landfill, and we all know that there's nothing sanitary about a landfill. They called it Whispering Pines Sanitary Landfill. I took this photograph in 1978, and my wife hired me, pro bono, to do the research for this lawsuit, Bean versus Southwestern Waste Management, Inc., 1978. This was the first lawsuit that was filed challenging environmental racism based on the siting of a facility. I worked for Texas Southern University, a state university. My wife sued my employer, the state of Texas. I did not have tenure, but the thing was, do the right thing. So when we talk about these issues of dumping and garbage and waste, these are environmental issues. Everybody produces waste, but everybody does not have to live where the waste is disposed. There is a direct correlation between per capita income and waste generation. However, there's an inverse relationship between where waste is disposed and income. There's not a whole lot of landfills and incinerators and garbage dumps in Beverly Hills for some reason. So when we talk about these issues, how I got involved was an accident on environmental issues. How I was able to look at, in the fourth largest city in the country, Houston, Texas, a city that was the petrochemical capital of the world, and at the same time, the African-American community was invisible. I wrote a book called Invisible Houston. I said, this should make a great title. Houston had a 500,000 African-Americans, and for some reason, they were invisible. I did a study in 1978 that was part of the lawsuit. And for my wife, who asked me, she said, Bob, I need somebody to collect data for this lawsuit. I need somebody who can work with census data, somebody who can collect the information and pinpoint where all these sites are located. I said, you need a sociologist. She said, that's what you do, right? I said, yeah. So I got drafted into this. had no other choice but to collect data for that lawsuit. And what we found in 1979 in the Houston Solid Waste Study and was published in Sociological Inquiry is that from the 20s up until 1978, the city basically used two forms of waste disposal, incineration and landfilling. 100% of all the city-owned landfills, 5 out of 5, during that period of time, from the 20s up until 1978, were located in predominantly black neighborhoods. Six out of 8 of the city-owned incinerators were located in predominantly black neighborhoods. 82% of all the garbage that was disposed of in the city of Houston during that period of time was disposed in predominantly black neighborhoods, even though African Americans only made up 25% of the population. That is disparate impact. That is an environmental injustice. That is a case of classic environmental racism. And it's immoral. It's illegal. And so my wife said, sue them. And she used a little more stronger words. When we look at this whole question of 1983, the birth of a whole movement. And it was born, the environmental justice movement was born in the South, the same region that gave us the birth of the civil rights movement. It is not by accident that there is a direct correlation between exploitation of land and exploitation of people. In Warren County, North Carolina, a classic case where this company got this oil that was contaminated with PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, and was trying to recycle it. The federal EPA basically banned the recycling of PCB-contaminated oil. This company opened the spigot along 14 counties in North Carolina and dumped it along the highway. The state of North, this is 1978. 1982, the North Carolina needed a place to dump the to dump this dirt that they dug up. And so they went through a very rigorous and scientific process, and they ended up picking one of the poorest counties in the state and one of the blackest counties in the state. North Carolina has 100 counties, and they picked a predominantly African-American county that is very poor. The only science involved in the selection process was political science. The people basically said no. Over 500 people were arrested, and you see the, on the screen, you see students, young people, community folks lining their bodies in streets in form of this, you know, defying these dump trucks filled with contaminated soil. And you see the North Carolina state troopers lining the streets, letting the people do this and arresting folks. When we talk about this whole question of how do we know that this is real, the first national study to document the correlation between where waste is disposed and race was not an academic institution, was not a governmental agency, was not a think tank. It was a civil rights organization, United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice. A civil rights organization documented the history and pattern. And they showed, using multivariate analysis, using sophisticated statistical techniques, that showed basically race was the most potent variable to location of landfills and hazardous waste facilities. And the director of that study was Benjamin Chavis, who was at the time director of the Commission for Racial Justice. In 1991, we got together. There were like a few of us got together and said, people of color must decide for themselves what their environment will be. And we have a summit, the first National People of Color Environmental Leadership Summit. And at that summit, we said we have to decide for ourselves and do for ourselves and challenge those who would turn our communities into toxic wastelands. We had the summit in Washington, D.C., a big conference. Over 1,000 delegates came from all over the world, as far away as the Marshall Islands, Chile, and including communities all across the continental USA. And anytime you have a big conference and summit in Washington, you have to have a demonstration. When we talk about this whole question, we said the first principle of environmental justice is that people must speak for themselves. Their voices must be heard. Doesn't mean that you have to agree. You don't have to agree with anything that I'm saying. But the principle of environmental justice is that we are talking about creating an atmosphere where participatory democracy can prevail. And democracy is very difficult. It is not easy. It slows the process down for these companies who really want to get permits and fast-track things. In most cases, when things are fast-tracked, our rights are violated. So when we talk about doing democracy, we have to do it right. When we talk about building a movement, we're talking about building a movement that is global, not domestic. When we tighten things down here, we tighten up the regulations, we make it more difficult for things to be sited. These Lulus, locally unwanted land uses, they drive them offshore. And just this past September, the World Conference Against Racism, there was a delegation that I was with that was focusing in on environmental justice and economic justice and environmental racism. And at the World Conference in Durban, our government came and left. But we stayed. We worked. And we said that the message was very clear at the World Conference in Durban, South Africa. We want to eliminate all forms of racism and discrimination and intolerance, whether it's dealing with environment, housing, transportation, employment, voting, education, health, you name it. It's the same. I've written 10 books, and it's the same book, but don't tell anybody. When we talk about these issues, even a child knows that environmental racism is illegal, it's immoral, it's unethical, and it's unhealthy. When we pay the price for dumping on people, for not cleaning up and not preventing what can be prevented, when we allow communities to be poisoned, when we allow unequal protection, when we allow, you know, where people to be poisoned in the workplace, when we allow chemicals to be dumped, when we allow non-sustainable development policies, and when we allow certain types of development patterns to occur, such as suburban sprawl, and this whole question of uneven development. And we talk about these issues. And so we are talking about confronting environmental racism. All of my books have nice titles, but they have great content also. When we talk about this whole question, there are some of us who really believe, and some of us have actually documented, that some of us do not have the complexion for protection. So when we talk about this question of race and class, and we talk about this question of, we have some of the best laws that are on the books, but in many cases, they are not enforced equally across the board. When we talk about this whole question of civil rights, and we talk about transportation, for example, the issue of transportation is part of the built environment. When we talk about this whole question of civil rights, it goes back to 1896 and Plessy v. Ferguson, where Plessy was told, get on the back of the bus. You know, you talk, it's 1896. It was not until Rosa Parks in 1956, talking about trying to deal with this issue of transportation segregation and transportation racism. And we talk about dismantling Jim Crow, 1954, Board of Education, Brown versus Board of Education. So when we talk about this Clean Air Act, we have great laws. Our environmental justice movement has really moved from grassroots groups and trickled all the way up to the White House. And on February 11th, 1994, President Clinton signed Executive Order 12898, the Executive Order on Environmental Justice. And that's the Oval Office. Beautiful office, great office. And the signing of an executive order was a historic event. And that even the President of the United States at the time said, we are not doing as good a job as we should in enforcing the environmental laws and the nexus between environment and civil rights laws. Breathing clean air, drinking clean water, eating food that is safe, having your kids play outside on parks that are safe and are not built on top of toxic waste dumps, having our kids attend schools that are not built on old waste sites, these are rights and not privileges. To say, if you don't lack it, vote with your feet. Some of us can't vote with our feet. Some of us don't have resources. Institutional racism and discrimination in housing still prevents some of us from leaving and moving to safer and healthier environments. So when you talk about this whole question, your physical environment can be hazardous to your health. And there is no safe place. This particular sign is posted right now in a community in Georgia, in Augusta, Georgia, Hyde Park neighborhood, that was the site of a Superfund site. And after they cleaned it up, they still have these signs posted. Don't dig in the yard. It's dangerous. Can be hazardous to your health. When kids play outside, what's the job of a kid is to dig in the dirt. So even when you clean up, even when you designate a place as safe, it is still not safe. We're talking about the politics of pollution, and all communities are not created equal. Lead poisoning is a preventable disease. Lead poisoning disproportionately impacts poor children who live in urban areas, in older housing, with chipping paint, with lead dust. The problem is not a scientific problem of not having documentation of what lead does to the body, and particularly the metabolism and the education and the learning and developmental capacity of kids. We have all the documentation, but having the facts is not enough. We have to have more commitment and resolve to end the problem, to prevent it from happening, because it costs much more to deal with kids who are being sent to reformatory schools and sent to prison because of behavioral problems that result from environmental degradation of lead. It is unethical, it is immoral to have lead in housing when we could get all the lead out right now. And if Dr. King was here right now, I think he would be saying the same thing and fighting to prevent our kids from being poisoned. And some of it is not all of the industries that's doing it. Some of it is us. We are in love with our cars. We're not just in love with our cars. We're in love with SUVs. We're in love with fossil fuels. And it is killing us. It is making us sick. Air pollution is driving us insane. And the fact that we got a lot of people living in cities that's non-attainment, that is unhealthy. And this is not a black thing, people. There are a lot of white folks who's breathing dirty air and getting sick. So when we talk about building networks across race, class, and geography and space, it's about justice. Bad air hurts, and it hurts the most vulnerable population. When we talk about a kid that has asthma and is sent to the emergency room and is leaving school, out of school, falling behind, it's an educational issue. So in the issues that we're talking about, it touches all of us. It touches all of us, and so we all have to pitch in to resolve it. Even though we have great, clean air here in Vermont, you pay. You are subsidizing the fact that in many cases, in areas that's polluted, your insurance rates are going higher, your taxes are going higher because of the unhealthy conditions that occur in different places across the globe. And so when we talk about this whole question of everybody produces waste and everybody produces garbage, we all have a solution. And it's not by accident. You know, the first book that I wrote about environmental racism was called Dumping in Dixie. But Dixie is not just in the South. Dixie is all over. But the South, because of its historical legacy of slavery and Jim Crow and resistance to civil rights, it is not by accident that the Southern United States is the most environmentally befouled region in the country. In many places, when I was writing this book, people would tell me, I was in Institute, West Virginia, and for some reason I was ignorant of the fact that there were black people in West Virginia. Well, this company, I'm going to call names because I have tenure, Union Carbide found them and put their plant right in the middle of the black community in Institute. So when we talk about these issues of environmental discrimination and this whole question of how industry can create toxic wastelands and the toxic terror that goes on in many communities. And this is Port Arthur, Texas. This is a public housing project that is inundated 24 hours a day with petrochemicals and pollution from these plants. And the people are told their emergency response is shelter in place. Close your windows. Lock your doors. Put water on the towels to block out the fumes and pray. Now, this is not America. That's basically sentencing people to death or health disparities that will show up later on in life. And so, in many cases, poor people don't have, you know, the luxury of having central air and central heat. A lot of our windows are cracked, doors are ajar. And so, even when you shelter in place, the stuff is coming in. That is not what America is about. We have a lot of black love canals all across the country where communities are trying and fighting and struggling to get relocated from these toxic wasteland. In Pensacola, Florida, this little lady, Margaret Williams, tough as nails, take no prisoner type, ex-Marine type, retired school teachers, fought and said, we want our community relocated, not some of us, but all of us. She fought the EPA and prevailed. Understand the Rosa Parks type. Rosa Parks lives today. Dr. King lives today. When we talk about these struggles, that are going on even as I speak. This is a case that was set, a lawsuit. This company, and I'm not going to call names. I'm going to call names now because I'm leaving this evening. In Anniston, Alabama, this company, Monsanto, poisoned this community. The community hired lawyers and experts, had to go to court This settlement just passed April for almost $43 million settlement. This community has to be relocated, removed. People are losing their community. They're losing their friends, their neighbors. It's going to kill a lot of old elderly people because they're going to have to move into a new community, a new environment where they don't have their support system. That is not what our industrial policy should be. They're going to lose their church. It's going to have to be relocated. You can't put a community down and put the church down in a new community like this. People are going to be scattered. Their community solidarity is going to be destroyed. And we talk about this whole question of having the facts. We've got lots of data. I worked on a case back in the 80s where this lead smelter is located next door, no buffer, between a public housing project. What you're looking at is a lead smelter stack and a school. It's located next to a school. And lead is doing nasty things for this school. And it took 3 studies, and it took a lawsuit, and we settled it for $26 million. But it has taken struggle. And when the EPA went in there in 1991, they went in moon suits to clean it up. This stuff is dangerous. It's killing people. We should be angry, and we should channel that anger into positive action and mobilization. That's what the environmental justice movement is about. That's what it's trying to do. And Louisiana is the toughest state right now when it comes to environmental justice. Louisiana is what Mississippi was in the 60s. It's a tough nut to crack. And there is this corridor called Cancer Alley from Baton Rouge to New Orleans where contamination is really wreaking havoc on communities. There is a middle class, solid middle class African American community called Agricultural Street Landfill Community. This is a black middle class community that is built beautiful homes, middle class homes, on top of a dump. The people want to be relocated just like the people were relocated from Love Canal. But they're fighting. Ironically, it was the Department of Housing and Urban Development that funded the development of the subdivision for this American dream of people in Louisiana, in New Orleans. But people having their lawsuits right now going on to get relocated from this particular hazardous waste site. In Louisiana, during the 30s and 40s, plantations prevailed. Sugarcane was king, and black folks worked on the plantations. In the 40s, post-World War II, the petrochemicals came in. They came in to replace the plantations. And so you find many plants now lining the Mississippi River. And one of the biggest petrochemical oil refineries is in Norco, Louisiana. And just across the street from this Shell refinery is a park. And without a doubt, every individual in Norco, Louisiana has asthma or an upper respiratory disease. Not just the children, everybody in that community. Breathing that nasty stuff, the pollution, noxious fumes, fugitive emissions from this particular plant. And so the issues that we're talking about are real. I mean, for some reason, and it's not just American companies that are doing it, it's also transnational. This is an example of another little old 75-year-old grandmother, tough as nails, Imelda West, went all the way to Tokyo, Japan, and met with the CEO of Shintech. And he's a very religious woman. And when she met with the CEO, she put the cross on him. She said, "You will not, Shintech, in the name of Jesus, locate in Convent, Louisiana." As it turns out, she organized and mobilized and worked with all kinds of community groups. Tulane Law students was the lawyers. Shintech did not locate in Convent, Louisiana. It took 18 months for them to fight and fend off. But the fact is that this community is already inundated with with millions of tons of pollution. They have 12 industrial plants in this one little place. 60% unemployment. So there is no correlation between where the plants are located and workings. This is the last example. There is an example, as I speak, there is a conflict going on right now, a dispute, where this landfill company in Montgomery wants to build a sanitary landfill, a garbage dump, on the historic Selma to Montgomery trail. In the 60s, people marched from Selma to Montgomery, not just black people, all kinds of people. People died, not just black people. People died marching from Selma to Montgomery to get the right to vote. extended to everybody. And as it turns out, this trail was declared a national treasure by President Clinton. It is a historical trail. This 54 miles of trail starts in Selma, and Selma is known for that famous stand at this bridge where black people, where John Lewis, Dr. Martin Luther King, and a whole bunch of people got bloodied at this bridge, and they want to put a garbage dump on the historic trail. That is an insult to our legacy. That is a trampling of our history, not black history, our history, American history, was made from at that famous march. When we talk about this whole question of it's about civil rights, it's about justice and fairness, it's about human rights. There was a delegation that went in last April that went to Geneva, Switzerland, and testified at the UN Human Rights Commission that the United States is in violation of the Human Rights Convention because we still have all kinds of discrimination, and environmental racism, environmental injustice is a human rights issue. So when we talk about bringing these issues on the world stage, they are global. Environmental justice is about building nets that work, building networks. When we were in South Africa, the Black Environmental Justice Network set up a booth, and our booth was visited by all people from all over. They said, we didn't know that there were environmental injustice in the United States. We didn't know about, these are people in different parts of the world. We said that there are still issues in terms of race and class, and that poor people and working class people still get the dirty end of the stick. And so when we talk about building these networks and information dissemination, our center at Clark Atlanta University is a center that provides information and a clearinghouse on all kinds of issues. And our website is very popular. We get over 50, 60,000 hits a week on our website of individuals visiting and trying to find information on all kinds of issues. The environment is a very essential part of our lives and the lives of future generations. If we don't take care of business today, Mother Earth will rebel against us and create the dangerous weather patterns, the El Niños, the hurricanes. You know, it will fight back, and we know it's not nice to mess with Mother Nature. Thank you very much.
That was sociologist and author Robert Bullard speaking last month in Burlington, Vermont. Thanks to Free Radio Burlington for that tape.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
They'll take your money and spread it.